Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Nicholas Walton. In every programme, we talk to the author of a new book that is especially interesting. And in this episode, that book is Africa United: How Football Explains Africa by Steve Bloomfield. It's almost a cliche to say that everywhere you turn in Africa, somebody is watching or playing football, but it's also fairly accurate. Well, Steve's book is an attempt to drill down and find out exactly what football says about Africa, while also drawing out some extraordinary stories. Here's the interview. And opposite me, joining me here in the offices high above Westminster, in the centre of London, I have Steve Bloomfield, the writer behind Africa United, How Football Explains Africa. And the whole point of this book is that wherever you turn in Africa, someone is playing football, someone is watching football. It's so central to almost the rhythm of life.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, football is everywhere in Africa, and I mean absolutely everywhere. Whether that's, you know, kids playing football in the streets, you know, from, you know, Freetown in Sierra Leone to Nairobi, Kenya, or whether that's people watching matches in bars, in video shacks, in their homes, and you get this, you know, across the continent. There are very few things where you can say Africa is, and, you know, and it makes it, and it's true for all 53 countries. But actually, football is one of those things where it doesn't matter where you are on the continent. You know, people love football, and people are passionate about it, and people are playing it.
And of course, you wrote this book after you were working in Africa as a journalist. You were the Independent's Africa correspondent. Can you give us a little bit more about your background, you know, where you came from, and how it all built up, I suppose, to writing this book?
Right, how it all built up. I guess I'd have to start it when I was 7 years old. And I always loved football from as long as I can remember. I played football in the playground at school. You know, I'd get to school early so we could play in the playground before school started. When we had break time, we'd play football. When we had lunch time, we played football. After school, we'd play football. And then when I was 7 years old, my dad took me to go and see Aston Villa. I'm from Birmingham, and Villa were the local side. And he is an Arsenal fan, so it was quite a big thing for him to take me to another club. But he wanted me to see live football and thought, you know, if I'm going to support anyone, I should support a local side. And I remember, you know, from the first moment I went to Villa Park, I was hooked and, you know, became a very passionate Villa fan, which I remain to this day. Not that's made me very happy, but it's, you know, it is what it is.
You mentioned that a few times in the book, how you're an Aston Villa fan and how it's not the best lot in life. But then again, my dad took me to my first football match. And I'm from Newcastle, so I could have ended up with quite a good team. I ended up with Middlesbrough.
Ooh,
and I've been stuck with them ever since. So Aston Villa is like the promised land as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I thought we were quite good until actually I moved to Nairobi, and which I've jumped forward a bit a few years there. But still, when I moved to Nairobi in 2006, Villa at the time were not bad. We'd finished sixth in the Premier League a couple of years in a row. And I noticed instantly arriving in Kenya that, yeah, football shirts were everywhere, that everyone seemed to be a football fan. But it didn't take me long to realise that no one was wearing a Villa shirt. They were all wearing English shirts, but it was Chelsea, it was Arsenal, it was Manchester United, sometimes a bit of Liverpool as well. Never Villa. And part of the book is a search for Villa fans in Africa. A small part. And I do find one eventually in Nigeria. But who was a genuine Villa fan, who, and this was the thing I loved about it, he was wearing a fake Aston Villa shirt, which, and it was a new fake Aston Villa shirt as well. It had the current sponsor on, it was very up to date, which made me realise there was someone in Lagos that had thought there was enough of a market for Villa shirts that he made a whole batch of them. Now, I never tracked down this guy, and I've no idea whether he sold more than one, but that gave me a little bit of hope.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you work in Africa? You were based in Nairobi, weren't you?
I was based in Nairobi. So I moved out in 2006. Before then, I'd been working at The Independent on Sunday for a few years, and I always wanted to be a foreign correspondent at some stage, and I've been fortunate enough to do some quite exciting trips. When I was at the Indy on Sunday, I went to Colombia for a while. I did a trip to North Korea. I did a couple of things in Europe. And and loved it and thought, this is the kind of journalism I really want to do. And then and Africa had always intrigued me as a continent. My grandfather had been there, and you know, when he was younger, it had been one of those places that I had a real interest in. Part of my degree at university had been in African politics. And then this position came up for The Independent as their Africa correspondent. And so I badgered the foreign editor for, you know, many weeks that he should, you know, let me go and do it. And eventually I wore him down. And so I got a plane to Nairobi. And I was there. I was probably based in Nairobi for about 4.5 years, initially for The Independent, and then also for Monocle, the magazine I work for now in London. And then my final 2 years in Nairobi, I was working on this book, Africa United. And you know, during that time, I travelled all over the continent. So I think 25, 26 countries across Africa I went to in the end. So everywhere from, you know, Somalia, Congo, Sudan to, you know, Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa.
And this book is about what you were covering as a journalist. It's about the life that you came across as a journalist, you know, poking your nose into all sorts of things and just seeing how Africans lived in these various countries. And all the time you're shadowed by this haunting spectre of football in the background. And just the way, as we were saying at the beginning, it almost sets the rhythm of life for some parts.
Well, I mean, there are a number of things that came together quite early on in my time there that made me think, you know, there could be an interesting, you know, story to tell. Partly there was the World Cup was coming up in South Africa. It was going to be the first time the World Cup was coming to the African continent. So that was a big thing. Then there was the fact that there were more African footballers in the European game. So in the top leagues, you know, most of the big clubs had African players. So, you know, whether that was Yaya Toure at Barcelona at the time, or it was Samuel Eto'o, or it was Michael Essien, or it was Didier Drogba. Yeah, there were big name African players in the way that there'd been far less of them maybe 10 years ago. Then there's, as I said, there was the fact that it was just played everywhere. Then there was the fact that it was on TV all the time, you know, particularly English football. And then the other thing that made me sort of think there was something in this was when I first moved to Kenya, I was trying to get my head around Kenyan politics. And, you know, to a certain extent, I'm still trying to get my head around it. It's, you know, it's incredibly complicated. There's no, it's has nothing to do with ideology. There's no left or right. You know, it's down to issues of ethnicity, tribalism, wealth, power, land, all these different things. And at the same time as I was trying to sort of understand the power dynamics here, I also wanted to try and understand a bit more about Kenyan football. I thought, you know, I'm a football fan. I'll, you know, go and see some local Kenyan Premier League matches. So I opened my copy of the Daily Nation and I turn to the sports pages and I look for the football fixtures. And I thought, this is a bit funny. There seems to be two Kenyan Premier Leagues here and they both seem to have the same clubs in. And yet they've both got different fixture lists. And here it says that Mathare United are playing at home this weekend. And in the other one, it says they're playing away. And this doesn't make sense. And it turned out that there was this, you know, massive political row going on in Kenyan football at the time, which is still sort of continuing now. And there were two rival leagues that were trying to claim ownership. And I soon realised that all the issues that affected Kenyan politics also affected Kenyan football. And over the next few months, the more I understood about one, the more I understood about the other. And so I started to think, well, maybe, you know, there's something broader to say here about football, that, you know, if you can understand a country's football, you can understand a country's politics. And that proved to be the case, I think, you know, in a number of countries across Africa. And I think can probably be said in, to a certain extent, about, you know, countries all over the world. And, you know, even here in England, you look at, you know, the, you know, the massive debt crisis that, you know, the top clubs have had. And look at the massive debt crisis we now have as a country. You know, there are similarities, you know, in, you know, between our football and our politics here. And so I thought, taking all those things together, this was a great way of telling a broader story about Africa that would hopefully appeal to an audience that, you know, that didn't necessarily know that much about the continent in the first place.
You mentioned there Africa almost playing out a kind of a shadow version of real life, almost a shadow version of politics in a country like Kenya. Throughout the book, what I found interesting was how you actually use football as a different. Sometimes it's a metaphor for things. Sometimes it's a kind of parallel world that goes on unaffected by what's actually happening on the streets. I'm thinking about places like Somalia. Sometimes it has a galvanizing role on a political situation, such as when you're talking about Cote d'Ivoire. Shall we start off with Kenya, though? Because you've just mentioned it. What I found interesting about Kenya was that it wasn't just that it was forming a kind of a second political life or whatever, however you wish to describe it, alongside real political life. The clubs actually seem to have a kind of social setup that mirrored some of the functions of a state. I mean, some of them almost seem to come out of it looking like NGOs. You know, they provided socially for people, etc.
Well,
tell us a bit about that.
Well, I mean, one club in particular, Mathare United. I mean, Mathare is one of the biggest and most dangerous at times slums in Nairobi. It really suffered during the post-election violence there in 2008, and yet they have this youth sports association, which was set up in the late 80s, which now has I think it's about 1500 teams and about 23,000 players,
all in this single slum.
And the teams don't just get points for winning matches. They get points for, you know, doing good things in their community, so clearing up rubbish, or for the older kids, attending sessions on HIV awareness. So there's it helps sort of solidify those sort of community links. And one of the interesting things generally within Kenyan football over the past few years is there's been a reform movement that has tried to get rid of the old corrupt guard. And they've been pretty successful. I mean, it's still tricky, but it's been pretty successful. And one of the top anti-corruption guys in Kenya, a guy called John Githongo, who had been a big campaigner, anti-corruption campaigner, had then become the president's main advisor on anti-corruption. Once he started to uncover corruption within the current regime, the president had turned against him. John then fled to the UK, fearing for his life. He got involved in Kenyan football, partly because he's a football fan, but also because his view was, everyone knows Kenyan football is corrupt. If you clean it up and show that it can become clean, then you are proving that other institutions, public institutions, that everyone knows are corrupt, can also become clean. And actually then football can be an example for other things. And the theory is true. I think he's 100% right on that. In practice, it hasn't necessarily happened, but I think you are seeing a change there, that a lot of the old sort of, you know, there's nothing we can do about this anymore, is starting to sort of shift away. And part of that, I do think, is down to the fact that, you know, what's happened in football has shown that actually there is a way that, you know, just because things have been corrupt in the past doesn't mean they have to be in the future.
Has anything happened to this strange two-league system that you were talking about?
Yeah, no, that was cleared up sort of fairly soon after I got there. There's now an independent Premier League, which is run by the clubs. They vote on everything themselves, so there's no, the incentives to cheat beforehand, you know, aren't really there. I mean, there used to be like really serious problems with, you know, referees, mm-hmm. you know, being paid to throw matches. That doesn't really happen now. And because it's clean, it's got sponsorship. So SuperSport, which is this Pan-African satellite broadcaster based in South Africa, now broadcasts Kenyan Premier League matches around the whole of Africa. Mm-hmm. And so not only is Kenyan football now being seen across Africa, but there's more money now in it. And so, you know, the players can be paid properly, whereas before they weren't.
Of course, that's no bar to a bit of corruption here and there.
No, it's not. But I think it does change things gradually, and it's become a more professional outfit.
Mm-hmm. And staying with Kenya just for a second, because obviously we had that situation after the last elections where there was an outbreak of violence, which obviously, as with Kenyan politics, followed fairly clear tribal lines. Mm. Is there any reflection of that in the football system as well? I mean, are there teams, for instance, that represent certain tribal groups?
There were. And actually, this is, again, the interesting thing. So there were teams that were, you know, seen as Luo teams or, mm-hmm. you know, seen as teams based around certain ethnic groups. But of course, as soon as you have a level playing field and you know there's no cheating, then if you run a club, you know, based in, let's say, in Western Kenya, and you think, you know, we just want Luo guys in our team.
Mm-hmm.
If suddenly you think, actually, we still want to win, and we used to be able to cheat to win, and now we can't, and there's these two good Kikuyu footballers, mm-hmm. Maybe we should get them in the team as well. And suddenly it breaks down those ethnic barriers that were there before, because you want the best possible team.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you need the best possible team to win, whereas in the past you didn't.
Absolutely.
So I think that has started to change things.
Strange. You really could be describing Scottish football when it started to move away from, obviously, Celtic and Rangers up in Glasgow with their Catholic and Protestant supporters. That all started to change as well. And then you had a couple of groundbreaking moves between the two clubs, and with a Catholic playing for Rangers and vice versa. And that started to crumble a whole way of... I mean, it hasn't changed everything up in Scotland. Do you see in the football system, and the way that you've just described it, it seems optimistic. Would that give you optimism about Kenya's future? Is that a step too far?
I think that's a slight step too far. I mean, I'm an optimist by nature. But, yeah, I mean, Kenya's still got, you know, really serious problems. And, you know, I think probably, you know, of more importance to Kenya's political future is the election of a very good new Chief Justice.
Mm-hmm.
Selection, rather. Which just happened recently. And, I mean, I think it's still too early to say, really. They've got elections coming up at the end of 2012. And if that all passes off peacefully, then, then yes, I think we can say things have moved in the right direction. But until then, I think it's, yeah, football can do many things, but it can't quite bring peace to Kenya just yet.
Okay. Well, let's move to a country that does test anyone's powers of optimism, and that's, you go slightly north from Kenya and you end up in Somalia.
Mm.
And there, the way that you portray football in your book, it seems as though it's almost an alternative world that allows people to escape from a pretty brutal reality on the streets of Mogadishu.
I mean, when I started to think about writing the book, I was trying to work out what countries to cover and what countries not to. And the way it's set out, I have 10 different chapters covering 13 different countries. And, you know, whenever I talk to people about what countries I was going to do, people would say, oh, well, you must write about Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
Or you must write about Mozambique. Or you must write about, you know, Zambia. And I remember by the time I'd finished my research, I probably had 30 countries that were on my shortlist. And I had to sort of whittle it down. And it would have been very easy to have done all the big successful countries like Ghana, like Senegal, so on, and ignore the countries like Somalia. But actually, Somalia was the one I found most fascinating because, no, they're never going to get to the World Cup. They're never going to get to the African Nations Cup. They're possibly, you know, the worst side in the world. I mean, they're rubbish. Mm-hmm. They weren't very good even before the last 20 years of wars. But they have a fascinating story to tell. The very fact that there is a national Somali team when there are no other national institutions in Somalia is in itself a massive achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this, you know, great mix within the team of guys from Mogadishu and, you know, and guys from the diaspora. So, yeah, the central defensive partnership at the East African Championships a few years ago was a guy called Hassan who's from Mogadishu, who, you know, has a really, really tough life in Mogadishu and wants to get out, but, you know, also has a wife and young kids and you know, was offered a contract in Yemen, but couldn't get his kids there as well, so had to turn it down. And playing alongside him was a guy called Guled, who lives here in London and plays for, or certainly did play for, Hanwell Town in the British Gas Southern League, and is also
an amateur team, basically. Yeah, so yeah. Quite a few rungs down the ladder, and even from Aston Villa.
And his job is he was a nightclub bouncer at the Trocadero at Leicester Square. So, you know, you had this, and these guys were playing alongside each other in the
for an international team. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you had some really passionate people who were determined to make sure that, you know, despite everything that was going on in Somalia, that they would fulfil their international fixtures, that when there were regional tournaments, they would send a squad there, they would, as they put it, fly the flag. And I was fortunate enough to see them win a match against Tanzania in the 2008 SACAFA Cup, which is the sort of Eastern Central African tournament, regional tournament. And it was the first time they won in a very, very long time. and it was, yeah, it was amazing just to, you know, to watch it happen.
So what is football in Somalia? Because I, like you, I had never, ever, ever associated Somalia with football. Well, until I read your book, of course. What does football in Somalia tell you about the country? I mean, you almost paint a picture of defiance in the in the face of a country that, well, not even a country, but a situation that's just crumbling. You have peacekeeping forces from outside Somalia, etc.
I mean, so to put it in context, Somalia's last proper government fell in 1991. And since then, there's been a series of overlapping civil wars, as well as, you know, slightly misguided foreign interventions, whether that's from the US, from Ethiopia, and from others as well, and now with, you know, people from the Middle East as well. And everything has fallen apart. You know, Mogadishu has become probably the most dangerous city in the world. You know, millions of people have fled. The world's largest refugee camp is now in northern Kenya, filled almost entirely with Somalis. The world's largest camp of internally displaced people is just outside Mogadishu in a place called Afgoy, where there's, you know, last count, I think 150,000 people there. It's almost impossible to get aid in there because there's no functioning government. So who do you, you know, who do you work with on the ground? It has numerous, numerous problems, quite aside from the ones which vex us in the West, like piracy and terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's got quite a proud sort of local football history. Somalia was an Italian colony, and you know, they had football before, but they... the Italians also encouraged football when they were there. The league, when it works in Somalia, is called Serie A. and, you know, there's a big stadium that was built there in the 80s, late 70s, I think, you know, which used to seat 60,000, which is now, you know, a military camp. You know, football's a big thing there. But they can't play it. You know, it's been impossible to play the league for 5 years. Partly because of war, and then also because Al-Shabaab, the Islamist militant group that control now most of southern and central Somalia, don't allow it. And there was this story about in 2006, I think it was now, when Al-Shabaab's sort of predecessor organisation, the Islamic Courts, were running Mogadishu, and the Somali team wanted to go and play the local, the regional tournament. And it was in Ethiopia, which is Somalia's sworn enemy. And so the clerics that are running Mogadishu said, look, we'll let you go, but on one condition. If you play Ethiopia, you must win. And if you don't win, you must not let them out of the stadium alive. Now, fortunately, Somalia were drawn in a different group from Ethiopia, so they didn't have to play them, which is just as well, because they would have lost. They lost every other match in that tournament. But yeah, I mean, they've just had a series of, you know, for the Somali FA, you know, they've had a series of, you know, obstacles thrown up that would put off most normal people, and yet they still make sure that every time they're supposed to play an international match, they'll be there.
Mm. We were just chatting before this interview started about one of the big hitters on the continent, Egypt. And you were very, very keen to chuck in a few words about exactly what was happening in Egypt. They have been... Egypt has been at the World Cup several times. It's won the African Cup of Nations several times. And it has two of the biggest clubs in Africa as well, on the continent, that have frequently won the club
African
competition
Champions
there.
League, yeah.
So...
Yeah, no, Egypt was fascinating. I mean, this book was obviously written before the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And what was particularly intriguing to me was how politicized football had become there. So Hosni Mubarak, associated himself with a successful Egypt side. And, partly because he controlled the media, that, he was able to, if he went to see an Egypt match, that would be the lead story on the news. Yeah, Hosni Mubarak visits, Egyptian footballers, breaking news. And that was his way of sort of identify himself with the Egyptian nation, or one of the ways he tried to do that. And in the run-up to the last World Cup, Egypt were trying to qualify. And they had to win their final match against Algeria by 3 goals to qualify.
Again, you're talking about sworn rivals.
Absolutely, absolutely. The last time this had happened was in 1989, when Egypt had won. They beat Algeria, and the match had ended in a riot. The Algerian players had rioted, and the Egyptian doctor had been hit over the head by a bottle, one of Algeria's best players, blinding him in one eye. There was an Interpol arrest, a warrant out for his arrest for 20 years.
Mm.
I mean, it was like, this is a serious, proper rivalry. And in the weeks leading up to this match, all everyone would talk about in Egypt was this match. They wouldn't talk about food prices. They wouldn't talk about unemployment. They wouldn't talk about the problems with Mubarak and how he was trying to get his son Gamal to succeed him. All of these things went away. And for the weeks leading up to this match, everything was focused on Egypt winning. And again, Mubarak and his son Gamal tried to associate themselves with this team and tried to build this picture of one Egypt with them at the forefront of it, essentially as sort of the leaders of the team. And then when Egypt lost and didn't qualify, there was this sort of huge sort of sense of anger. And the government made sure this anger was directed at the Algerians. And so, there was a big riot outside the Algerian embassy. Thousands of people throwing Molotov cocktails. And it just struck me at the time, I mentioned this at the end of the chapter, it was how just fundamentally depressing it was that there was this huge groundswell of anger that the government's able to manipulate and say, it's all the Algerians' fault. And yet you didn't see the same anger against the government itself. And then, of course, 12 months later, you did in quite dramatic ways. I don't think, football helped to bring down the government in any way. I don't think there's a link like that. But I thought it was interesting that the government at the time was able to try and manipulate this anger in a way that obviously in the end they couldn't.
Mm. But there is another country that you do talk about in the book where football itself does play a central role. If you go over to the west of the continent, you end up in Côte d'Ivoire. And you have a particularly successful team there led by Didier Drogba. At the same time as you have a conflict between the north and south, and obviously this is something that it's been back in the news since you wrote the book. But can you explain what your kind of thesis was about football being a healing force?
Well, I think, as you say, I mean, I said at the start, by nature an optimist. And I think it's, in hindsight, I think I've been slightly too optimistic about about Côte d'Ivoire. I mean, particularly as we've seen what happened. But I mean, to go back to you know, to the original story, you know, this was a very successful country in West Africa, post-independence, strong economy. Things started to fall apart in the late 90s, and they had a problem with it. There was essentially a divide opened up between North and South. The South tended to be more Christian. The North tended to be more Muslim. There'd also been a lot of immigrants into the North that come because there was a strong economy and because the
from Burkina Faso,
Mainly from Burkina Faso, but also from elsewhere. And then politics became increasingly poisonous. Laurent Gbagbo, who ruled for about 10 years up until recently earlier this year, started talking about this sense of Ivorite, sort of Ivorianness, claiming that these guys in the north didn't have it and they weren't truly Ivorian. And the country, there was a civil war, and the country was split between north and south. Now, during this time, the national football team was one of the few national institutions which still existed and which still had people from both sides of the divide. And so Drogba was from the south. The Touré brothers were from the north. There was a real mix within the team. And on the whole, these guys got on. And at the same time as, this was happening, this team was pretty successful. They qualified for the World Cup for the first time in 2006. They got to the final of the African Nations in 2006. They were a successful side. And, Drogba in particular tried to push this message of peace, that we're all Ivorians together and that, that we can... that we should be united. And there are a succession of attempts at peace deals, and that they all sort of fell by the wayside. And then the one that stuck in the end was in 2007, early 2007. But it wasn't really until Drogba went to the north, to Bouaké, which was the rebel-held capital in the north, and said, we should have our next international match here to essentially seal the deal, to prove that we're one, Côte d'Ivoire again. That things really, that most Ivorians really felt, yes, okay, we feel this is sort of happening. This is a proper peace deal. And so, sure enough, the match happened in Bouaké. It was against Madagascar. It was an African Nations qualifier. They won 5-0. Drogba scored the final goal.
Against Madagascar.
Yeah, against Madagascar. But still,
it was perfectly teed up, wasn't it?
But it was, everyone that was there on that occasion says, yes, this is the moment where, we felt like one nation again. And so it was widely seen as that was sort of the icing on the cake, and it helped sort of bring the country together. Why I'm sort of wonder whether I was slightly too optimistic now in hindsight is because obviously, this peace deal fell apart 2 or 3 years later, and you had a very fractious election, almost went back to war, and Gbagbo in the end was holed up in a bunker beneath the presidential palace, it didn't end in the way that one would have hoped. I think there is a on the whole there was a story to tell there about how football had helped be a uniting force. I think to say that, they were the ones that brought peace to the country would be taking it too far, but they certainly were a very important glue that helped to give a semblance of national unity during the Civil War, and also helped to cement that peace when it happened in 2007. And I think, there are still problems in Côte d'Ivoire, big problems, but that I think was really sort of one of the, I think it really helped to sort of bring the country together at certain key times, and certainly that was the moment where you ask a lot of Ivorians, when did you feel this peace deal was going to work? They'll say it was the match in Bouaké.
It's interesting when you talk about figures like Drogba and the Touré brothers. There's a lot of pride in a lot of African countries about players who actually make it for the big international teams. And there's also, as you were reflecting earlier, especially about Kenya, but obviously the league seems a little bit more established now. But how can I put it? The local teams, the local leagues just don't seem to pick up as much attention. No. Everyone crowds into the local bars to watch Barcelona play, Manchester United play, etc., etc. What do you think is going on there? Do you feel as though it's a sign that Ivorians or Nigerians or whatever can make it on the big stage, or is it almost a way of escaping the immediate surrounds of wherever these matches are being watched?
Well, I think it's several things. Okay, for the footballers, let's take them initially. For them, it's about, it's mainly about money. If you're going to play in the Nigerian league, you're going to get paid very, very little. You might not even get paid at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the league's very badly organised. It's incredibly corrupt. There are huge problems. If you can play for Chelsea and earn £60,000 a week, then you're going to go and do that.
There's very few things that compare to that. It's not just playing in the Nigerian
league. No, exactly. But I mean, that's
for a medium ranking team somewhere stuck in a relatively small outpost of Europe.
Well, I mean, the amount of money you're going to earn playing for Helsingborg in Sweden is going to be far more than you will earn playing for Bielsa United in Nigeria. I mean, it's just, far, far more. And also, there's a chance it will lead on to, bigger and better things.
Mm-hmm.
So for the players, it's a no-brainer. You go, you go to where the more professional outfit is. And I think, that's the same for a lot of people. It would be the same. And I think you can also draw a link here with sort of, migration routes from Africa to Europe. In that people feel that that's where you can have a proper career, or that's where you can make some money. So at lots of different levels. So there's that. For the fans, it's now you've got satellite TV. On a Saturday afternoon, if you've got a choice of going to a bar and watching the best footballers in the world, or going down the road to a stadium and watching a local side play not very good football on a not very good pitch in a stadium filled with not many people, what are you going to do? There are very few clubs in Africa that have a real following amongst fans. There are some exceptions. There's we've mentioned Egypt. There's Al Ahly and Zamalek there.
And in South Africa
there's Orlando Pirates and Kaizer Chiefs. In there's a couple of other places, people, a lot of people support St. George's in Ethiopia, or TP Mazembe in Congo.
Exactly.
There are certain exceptions, but on the whole, the big clubs that people want to watch are, and they feel a link to, are the big European clubs. You ask any African man, in his 20s, who do you support? They will give you the name of the European club, probably a British club, probably Manchester United, Chelsea, or Arsenal. Never Villa, but never Middlesbrough.
We had Joseph De Zero Job from Cameroon once.
Well, there might be someone in Cameroon who knows about him. But and it's partly chicken and egg.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some clubs could do more to attract more of a local fan base. I think they really need to. But it's a problem, I think, for African football.
You do have some clubs, not just the big established ones such as the Egyptian or South African ones that we were just mentioning, but you mentioned TP Mazembe.
Yeah.
Now that is one that does actually have ambitions that stretch well beyond its little corner of Katanga in the south of DRC.
Jesus. So
I just want to mention it. It almost reflects the big man idea as well. There's one man behind the whole the club, but it's also got a much longer heritage than I realised.
Yeah, I mean it was set up. It was set up quite a while ago, and they actually won the African Champions Cup twice in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And then things sort of went wrong. But I first met the president of the club in Harare, Mm-hmm. And I was there to watch a African Champions League game between Monama Tapa, who were the champions of Zimbabwe at the time, and TP Mazembe. And I'd been spending a bit of time with the guys at Monama Tapa. Can't say that right without the water. Monama Tapa. And, you know, they were talking about the struggles with Zimbabwean football and, you know, how little money they had and, you know, how bad the league was at the time. And I asked, well, what's your budget? You know, how much does it cost you a year to keep this club running? And they said it's about $200,000 US, yeah, mm-hmm, for a whole season, for a year. And then I met Moise Katumbi, who's the president of TP Mazembe and, mm-hmm, also the governor of Katanga province and also a billionaire. And I said, what's your budget? And he sort of laughed and said, you know, what, for this match or for the Champions League or for the whole season? I said, okay, well, what about just for this match? He says, well, the win bonus that I'll share out amongst the players and staff, if we're successful today, is $250,000. And, you know, that was the difference between, you know, between his club and...
That's not just European levels, that's top European levels.
Yeah, and you know, and some of the players are on serious money. They're on like several thousand dollars a week, which meant that, you know, when big European clubs, well, when medium-sized European clubs came in for them, you know, A, TP Mazembe didn't need to sell because they didn't need the money, and B, the players didn't necessarily think it was worth their while going to Belgium, say, you know, a small club in Belgium, when they'll probably earn more, you know, playing for the biggest club in Africa.
Sorry, can I interrupt? I mean, Katanga, it's almost de rigueur to include as a prefix mineral-rich Katanga. Mm. And in a sense, you can see some of this money going into, you know, bypassing the people of the area and going straight into the pockets of footballers. This is something that's very easy to get moralistic about. But after all, this is also happening from, you know, in Chechnya, you've got Kadyrov building up a football team.
Well, I mean, it's very easy to get moralistic about what's happening in Chechnya as well. I mean, it's, you know, yes, what's happening.
But that's what I'm trying to say. Do you feel as though there's anything, because of the situation for many people in a place such as the DRC, there is a real need to be careful with what happens and where the money goes and whether it is seen to go so blatantly into the pockets of footballers
as opposed to
the wider community?
I don't have too much problem with some of it going to the pockets of footballers, because I also think actually it's, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a great deal of money compared to the amount that's going straight into the pockets of the, you know, the Congolese... yeah, for want of a better word, oligarchs. So, yeah, I mean, it's... Yeah, I must say, it's of all the things that I can get worked up about in African football, that's probably one of the smaller things. I mean, I think, you know, it's not... you know, in football terms, it's not really a level playing field. You know, in that TP Mazembe have huge amounts of money and no one else really does. Which is why they've, you know, won the African Champions League 2 years running, and, you know, can afford to, you know, to buy the best players and pick up the best players from wherever they want. I mean it does throw up some of these moral issues about, you know, in the same way as here. You know, we've got players on, you know, Carlos Tevez is on £250,000 a week. Mm-hmm. You know, playing in front of fans who, I doubt there's a single Manchester City fan going down every week who earns £250,000 in a year.
Apart from the ones from Abu Dhabi, that is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Apart from the owners. So, I mean, I think that's just a general sort of problem with, you know, market capitalism rather than a specific Congolese problem.
Or African one.
Yeah.
I don't want to spend too much longer on the interview because it's always easy to keep overrunning with these things. So I suppose I wanted to get to one of the things that a lot of people know about African football, and that is there was a fateful comment. It was Pele who said that he thought an African team would win the World Cup by 2000 or something.
Yeah, yeah. Walter Winterbottom actually first said it.
Okay. England coach.
Yeah, yeah. The first England coach. He said it in the 50s, I think. Mm. And yeah, I mean, and Pelé also, you know, says a lot of nonsense. but yeah, you're going to ask whether you think actually that's possible.
Well, I mean, obviously it's not possible. Well, obviously, possible,
it's not possible to be 2000, yeah. But, you know, but when's it going to happen?
But, I mean, what we've been talking about is football as an enormous and an enormously popular force where in African society, they're starting to get the business sorted out. They're obviously producing the players that are starting to be the stars of some of the biggest teams in the world. Do you feel as though there's any hint that this is going to happen in the near future?
Yes. And I think, you know, let's not forget, it almost happened, you know, in 2010. You know, Ghana should have got to semi-finals of the World Cup. You know, if Suarez hadn't handled on the line, and if, you know, Gian hadn't then hit the bar with a penalty, they would have been in the semis. Who knows what might have happened then? I mean, I think there are two big things holding African football back, and that is organisation and corruption. And I think it's no surprise that Ghana were the team that did well when Ghana's FA is, and Ghana's league is relatively good. Its FA is relatively good, and they invest in youth development. And you saw that, you know, they won the Under-20 World Cup the year before. They've got a lot of good young players coming through. Mm-hmm. You compare them with Nigeria, who had, you know, who've got some fantastic players, or have had some fantastic players. But they had the most chaotic preparation for a World Cup you could ever imagine. You know, everything from, you know, the plane that was supposed to be taking them there broke down, to organising friendly matches, which then had to be called off, to, you know, booking a hotel, which was then in the wrong part of the country. I mean, everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong. You know, Cote d'Ivoire, their preparation was ludicrous. They had this very good coach who lost one match in 22, I think, or something, over the previous 2 years. But because he lost one match, they sacked him. So then hired Sven-Göran Eriksson 3 months before the tournament, who didn't speak a word of French. And the Ivorian players, a lot of them don't speak any English. I know, I've tried to interview half of them. And they hired him just for the World Cup. And so, of course, their preparation was going to be bad. Nigerian's coach, you know, was hard just for the World Cup. So, of course, their preparation is going to be bad. So it's, you know, these are sort of simple mistakes that are being made that, you know, if Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria and Cameroon had all had better preparation for this World Cup, you know, they all could and should have got to the second round, and then who knows. And I think, you know, it's not impossible for an African team to win in 2014 in Brazil. Not impossible at all. You know, I wouldn't say any of them are going to be favourites, but, you know, I would not be surprised if an African side reached semi-finals in 2014. I think once you reach the semis, then, you know, anything can happen.
Well, that was a football question. Let's finish on a particularly African question. What's your favourite place in Africa? Where have you visited that you still think back and think, my goodness me, that was special?
It's funny. A lot of people ask that, and my question is always, people go, what, really? And my favourite place, oddly, was Mogadishu. I just, you know, met so many people there that I loved and were just amazing. And it is, despite everything, still very beautiful and, you know, right on the coast. And
that comes through in the book, by the way.
Oh, good. Okay, great. Yeah.
I've never been.
I don't suggest you go. It's still ridiculously dangerous and I wouldn't go now at all. But it's stunningly beautiful and, yeah, the people have got such a, you know, it's always so cliche to say, oh, the people are wonderful. But, yeah, you know, a lot of the people, you know, a lot of my friends there are wonderful and they're just, and, you know, determined to, you know, get through everything that's put in their way. And people, you know, you don't ever want to get on the wrong side of an argument with. But aside from Somalia, I mean, Kenya is, you know, Kenya was our home for 4 or 5 years. And for all its problems, it's, you know, it's an amazing country. And it was, you know, it wasn't just the place that we lived. It was our home and, you know, absolutely loved living there. And yeah, it's got incredible scenery, incredible wildlife. The coast, brilliant. You know, the lakes are great. Nairobi is a really vibrant city. Loads going on.
And the football is improing.
Yeah, I still wouldn't, you know.
it's not going to be them winning.
To be
World
honest,
Cup.
If it on a Saturday afternoon, it's a choice between, you know, going to the bar and watching, you know, English football, or going down to Nyayo Stadium and watching Kenyan football, I have to say, go and watch the English football, as would, you know, 99.9% of all Kenyans.
Steve, thank you very much indeed.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was my interview with Steve Bloomfield, the author of Africa United, How Football Explains Africa. A really enjoyable, insightful, and at times surprising read. This is Nicholas Walton from the New Books Network, wishing you a good day from here in London.